Dad's arthritis. Yeah, Gramps' arthritis is pretty bad too. In his hip. Arthritis? Could this be any more like a Christmas card update? And Billy finished swimming lessons, and Todd knocked up his girlfriend, and Aunt Louise had her bunions removed. Oh, that sucks, I say. You know how he is. He's all stoic about it. In fact, he and Gran are gearing up to do a lot of traveling to visit me on the road. Got themselves new passports. Gran even found a horticulture student to look after her orchids when she's away. So how are you, Gran's orchids? I ask. Excellent. We've moved on to flowers now. Still winning prizes, so I guess they must be doing well. Mia looks down. I haven't seen her greenhouse in a while. I haven't been back there since I came out here. I'm both surprised by this and not. It's like I knew it already, even though I thought that once I skipped town, Mia might return. Once again, I've overestimated my importance. You should look them up sometime, she says. They'd be so happy to hear from you, to hear about how well you're doing. How well I'm doing? When I look up at her, she's peering at me from under a waterfall of hair, shaking her head in wonder. Yeah, Adam, how amazing you're doing. I mean, you did it. You're a rock star. Rock star. The words are so full of smoke and mirrors that it's impossible to find a real person behind them. But I am a rock star. I have the bank account of a rock star and the platinum records of a rock star and the girlfriend of a rock star. But I fucking hate that term. And hearing Mia pin it on me ups the level of my loathing to a new stratosphere. Do you have any pictures of the rest of the band? She asks. On your phone or something? Yeah, pictures. I have a ton on my phone, but it's back at the hotel. Total bullshit, but she'll never know. And if it's pictures she wants, I can just get her a copy of Spin at a corner newsstand. I have some pictures. Mine are actual paper pictures because my phone is so ancient. I think I have some of Gran and Gramps, and oh, a great one of Henry and Willow. They brought their kids to visit me at the Marlboro Festival last summer, she tells me. Beatrix, or Trixie as they call her. Remember their little girl? She's 5 now. And they had another baby, a little boy, Theo, named for Teddy. At the mention of Teddy's name, my gut seizes up. In the calculus of feelings, you never really know how one person's absence will affect you more than another's. I loved Mia's parents, but I could somehow accept their deaths. They'd gone too soon, but in the right order, parent before child. Though not, I supposed, from the perspective of Mia's grandparents. But somehow I still can't wrap my head around Teddy staying 8 years old forever. Every year I get older, I think about how old Teddy would be too. He'd be almost 12 now, and I see him in the face of every zitty adolescent boy who comes to our shows or begs an autograph. I never told Mia about how much losing Teddy gutted me back when we were together, so there's no way I'm going to tell her now. I've lost my right to discuss such things. I've relinquished, or been relieved of, my seat at the Hall family table. I took the picture last summer, so it's a little old, but you get the idea of how everyone looks. Oh, that's okay. But Mia's already rooting through her bag. Henry still looks the same, like an overgrown kid. Where is my wallet? She heaves the bag onto the table. I don't want to see your pictures. My voice is as sharp as ice cracking, as loud as a parent's reprimand. Mia stops her digging. Oh, okay. She looks chastened, slapped down. She zips her bag and slides it back into the booth, and in the process knocks over my bottle of beer. She starts frantically grabbing at napkins from the dispenser to sop up the brew, like there's battery acid leaking over the table. Damn, she says. It's no big deal. It is. I've made a huge mess, Mia says breathlessly. You got most of it. Just call your buddy over and he'll get the rest. She continues to clean maniacally until she's emptied the napkin dispenser and used up every dry paper product in the vicinity. She balls up the soiled napkins, and I think she's about to go at the tabletop with her bare arm, and I'm watching the whole thing, slightly perplexed, until Mia runs out of gas. She stops, hangs her head. Then she looks up at me with those eyes of hers. I'm sorry. I know the cool thing to do is say it's okay. It's no big deal. I didn't even get beer on me. But all of a sudden, I'm not sure we're talking about beer. And if we're not talking about beer, if Mia's issuing some stealth apology, what are you sorry about, Mia? Even if I could bring myself to ask that, which I can't, she's jumping out of the booth and running toward the bathroom to clean the beer off herself like she's Lady Macbeth. She's gone for a while, and as I wait, the ambiguity she left in the booth curdles its way into the deepest part of me. Because I've imagined a lot of scenarios over the last 3 years. Most of them versions of this all being some kind of huge mistake, a giant misunderstanding. And a lot of my fantasies involve the ways in which Mia grovels for my forgiveness, apologizes for returning my love with the cruelty of her silence, for acting as though 2 years of life, those 2 years of our lives, amount to nothing. But I always stop short of the fantasy of her apologizing for leaving, because even though she might not know it, she just did what I told her she could do. Chapter 9. There were signs. Probably more of them than I ever caught, even after the fact. But I missed them all. Maybe because I wasn't looking for them. I was too busy checking over my shoulder at the fire I'd just come through to pay much attention to the 1,000-foot cliff looming in front of me. When Mia had decided to go to Juilliard that fall, and when by late that spring it became clear that she'd be able to, I'd said I'd go with her to New York. She'd just given me this look. No way. That was never on the table before, she said. So why should it be now? Because before you were a whole person, but now you don't have a spleen. Or parents. Because New York might swallow you alive, I'd thought. I didn't say anything. It's time for both of us to get back to our lives, she continued. I'd only been at the university part-time before, but had just stopped going after the accident and now had a term's worth of incompletes. Mia hadn't been back to school either. She'd missed too much of it, and now she worked with a tutor to finish up her senior year classes so she could graduate and go to Juilliard on time. It was more going through the motions. Her teachers would pass her even if she never turned in another assignment. And what about the band? She asked. I know they're all waiting on you. Also true. Just before the accident, we recorded a self-titled record on Smiling Simon, a Seattle-based independent label. The album had come out at the beginning of the summer, and even though we hadn't toured to support it, the CD had been selling up a storm, getting tons of play on college radio stations. As a result, Shooting Star now had major labels circling, all interested in signing a band that existed only in theory. Your poor guitar is practically dying of neglect, she said with a sad smile. It hadn't been out of its case since our aborted opening act for Bikini. So, I agreed to the long-distance thing. In part because there was no arguing with Mia. In part because I really didn't want to quit Shooting Star. But also, I was kind of cocky about the distance. I mean, before I'd been worried about what the Continental Divide would do to us. But now? What the hell could 2,500 miles do to us now? And besides, Kim had accepted a spot at NYU a few miles downtown from Juilliard. She'd keep an eye on Mia. Except then Kim made a last-minute change and switched to Brandeis in Boston. I was furious about this. After the accident, we frequently had little chats about Mia's progress and passed along pertinent info to her grandparents. We kept our talk secret, knowing Mia would have killed us had she thought we were conspiring. But Kim and I, we were like co-captains of Team Mia. If I couldn't move to New York with Mia, I felt Kim had a responsibility to stay near her. I stewed about this for a while, until one hot July night, about a month before she and Mia were due to leave. Kim had come over to Mia's grandparents' house to watch DVDs with us. Mia had gone to bed early, so it was just the two of us finishing some pretentious foreign movie. Kim kept trying to talk to me about Mia, how well she was doing, and was jabbering over the film like a noisy parrot. I finally told her to shut up. Her eyes narrowed, and she started gathering her stuff. I know what you're upset about, and it's not this lame movie, so why don't you just yell at me about it already and get it over with, she said. Then she'd burst out crying. I'd never seen Kim cry, full on like this, not even at the memorial service, so I'd immediately felt like crap and apologized and sort of awkwardly hugged her. After she'd finished sniveling, she dried her eyes and explained how Mia had made her choose Brandeis. I mean, it's where I really want to go. After so long in Goy, Oregon, I really wanted to be at a Jewish school. But NYU was fine, and New York is plenty Jewish. But she was fierce on this. She said she didn't want any more babysitting. Those were her exact words. She swore that if I went to NYU, she'd know it was because we'd hatched a plan to keep an eye on her. She said she'd cut ties with me. I told her I didn't believe her, but she had a look in her eye I'd never seen. She was serious, so I did it. Do you know how many strings I had to pull to get my spot back this late in the game? Plus, I lost my tuition deposit at NYU. But whatever, it made Mia happy, and not a lot does these days. Kim smiled ruefully. So I'm not sure why it's making me feel so miserable. Guilt, I guess. Religious hazard. Then she'd started crying again. Pretty loud sign. I guess I had my fingers in my ears. But the end, when it finally came, was quiet. Mia went to New York. I moved back to the House of Rock. I went back to school. The world didn't end. For the first couple of weeks, Mia and I sent each other these epic emails. Hers were all about New York, her classes, music, school. Mine were all about our record label meetings. Liz has scheduled a bunch of gigs for us around Thanksgiving, and we had some serious practicing to do before then, given that I hadn't picked up a guitar in months. But at Mike's insistence, we were seeing to business first. We were traveling to Seattle and L.A. and meeting label execs. Some A&R guys from New York were coming out to Oregon to see us. I told Mia about the promises they made, how each of them said they'd hone our sound and launch us to superstardom. All of us in the band tried to keep it in check, but it was hard not to inhale their stardust. Mia and I also had a phone call check-in every night before she went to bed. She was usually pretty wiped, so the conversations were short, a chance to hear one another's voice, to say I love you in real time. One night, about 3 weeks into the semester, I was a little late calling because we were meeting one of the A&R reps for dinner at Le Pigeon in Portland, and everything ran a little late. When my call went to voicemail, I figured she'd already gone to sleep. But the next day, there was no email from her. "Sorry I was late. You pissed at me?" I texted her. "No," she texted right back, and I was relieved. But that night, I called on time, and that call went right to voicemail. And the next day, the email from Mia was a terse 2 sentences, something about orchestra getting very intense. So I justified it. Things were starting to heat up. She was at Juilliard, after all. Her cello didn't have Wi-Fi, and this was Mia, the girl known to practice 8 hours a day. But then I started calling at different times, waking up early so I could get her before classes, calling during her dinner time, and my calls kept going to voicemail, never getting returned. She didn't return my texts either. I was still getting emails, but not every day. And even though my emails were full of increasingly desperate questions, why aren't you picking up your cell? Did you lose it? Are you okay? Her responses glossed right over everything. She just claimed to be busy. I decided to go visit her grandparents. I'd pretty much lived with them for 5 months while Mia was recovering and had promised to visit frequently, but I'd reneged on that. I found it hard to be in that drafty old house with its photo gallery of ghosts, a wedding portrait of Denny and Kat, a gut-wrenching shot of 12-year-old Mia reading to Teddy on her lap without Mia beside me. But with Mia's contact dwindling, I needed answers. The first time I went that fall, Mia's grandmother talked my ear off about the state of her garden and then went out to her greenhouse, leaving me to sit in the kitchen with her grandfather. He brewed us a strong pot of coffee. We didn't say much, so all you could hear was the crackling of the wood stove. He just looked at me in that quiet, sad way that made me inexplicably want to kneel at the foot of his chair and put my head in his lap. I went back a couple more times, even after Mia had cut off contact with me completely, and it was always like that. I felt kind of bad pretending that I was there on social calls when really I was hoping for some news, some explanation. No, what I was really hoping for was not to be the odd man out. I wanted them to say, "Mia has stopped calling us. Has she been in touch with you?" But of course that never happened because that never would happen. The thing was, I didn't need any confirmation from Mia's grandparents. I knew from that second night when my call went to voicemail that it was the end of the line for me. Because hadn't I told her? Hadn't I stood over her body and promised her that I'd do anything if she stayed, even if it meant letting her go? The fact that she'd been in a coma when I'd said this, hadn't woken up for another 3 days, that neither of us had ever mentioned what I'd said, that seemed almost irrelevant. I brought this on myself. The thing I can't wrap my head around is how she did it. I've never dumped a girl with such brutality. Even back when I did the groupie thing, I'd always escort the girl du jour out of my hotel room or limo or whatever, give her a chaste kiss on the cheek and, thanks, that was a lot of fun, or something with a similar note of finality in it. And that was a groupie. Mia and I had been together for more than 2 years, and yes, it was a high school romance, but it was still the kind of romance where I thought we were trying to find a way to make it forever. The kind that Had we met 5 years later, and had she not been some cello prodigy, and had I not been in a band on the rise, or had our lives not been ripped apart by all this, I was pretty sure it would have been. I've come to realize there's a world of difference between knowing something happened, even knowing why it happened, and believing it. Because when she cut off contact, yeah, I knew what had happened, but it took me a long, long time to believe it. Some days, I still don't quite believe it. Chapter 10. Barrel of the gun, rounds 1, 2, 3. She says I have to pick. Choose you or choose me. Metal to the temple. The explosion is deafening. Lick the blood that covers me. She's the last one standing. Roulette. Collateral damage, track 11. After we leave the diner, I start to feel nervous, because we bumped into each other. We did the polite thing and stuck around to catch up, so what's left except our goodbyes. But I'm not ready for that. I'm pretty sure there's not going to be another postscript with Mia, and I'm going to have to live on the fumes of tonight for the rest of my life, so I'd like a little more to show for it than parking lots and arthritis and aborted apologies. Which is why every block we walk that Mia doesn't hail a cab or make excuses and say goodnight feels like a stay of execution. In the sound of my footsteps slapping against the pavement, I can almost hear the word reprieve, reprieve, echo through the city streets. We walk in silence down a much quieter, much scummier stretch of 9th Avenue. Underneath a dank overpass, a bunch of homeless guys camp out. One asks for some spare change. I toss him a 10. A bus goes by, blasting a cloud of diesel exhaust. Mia points across the street. "That's the Port Authority bus terminal," she says. I just nod, not sure if we're going to discuss bus stations with the same amount of detail we did parking lots, or if she's planning on sending me away. "There's a bowling alley inside," she tells me. "In the bus station? Crazy, right?" Mia exclaims, suddenly all animated. I couldn't believe it when I found it either. I was coming home from visiting Kim in Boston late one night and got lost on the way out, and there it was. It reminded me of Easter egg hunts. Do you remember how Teddy and I used to get about those? I remember how Mia used to get. She'd been a sucker for any holiday that had a candy association, especially making it fun for Teddy. One Easter, she'd painstakingly hand-colored hard-boiled eggs and hidden them all over the yard for Teddy's hunt the next morning. But then it poured all night, and all her colorful eggs had turned to mottled gray. Mia had been tearfully disappointed, but Teddy had practically peed himself with excitement. The eggs, he declared, weren't Easter eggs. They were dinosaur eggs. "Yeah, I remember," I say. "Everyone loves New York City for all these different reasons. The culture, the mix of people, the pace, the food. But for me, it's like one epic Easter egg hunt. You're always finding these little surprises around every corner. Like that garden. Like a bowling alley in a giant bus depot. You know..." She stops. "What?" She shakes her head. "You probably have something going tonight. A club, an entourage to meet." I roll my eyes. "I don't do entourage, Mia." It comes out harder than I intended. "I didn't mean it as an insult. I just assumed all rock stars, celebrities, traveled with packs." "Stop assuming. I'm still me." "Sort of." She looks surprised. "Okay, so you don't have anywhere you need to be?" I shake my head. "It's late. Do you need to get to sleep?"
"I don't do much of that these days. I can sleep on the plane."
"So..."
Mia kicks away a piece of trash with her toe, and I realize she's still nervous.
"Let's go on an urban Easter egg hunt."
She pauses, searches my face to see if I know what she's talking about. And of course I know exactly what she's talking about.
"I'll show you all the secret corners of the city that I love so much."
"Why?" I ask her. And then as soon as I ask the question, I want to kick myself. "You got your reprieve. Now shut up." But part of me does want to know. If I'm unclear why I went to her concert tonight, I'm thoroughly confused as to why she called me to her, why I'm still here.
"Because I'd like to show you," she says simply.
I stare at her, waiting for her to elaborate. Her brows knit as she tries to explain. Then she seems to give up. She just shrugs. After a minute, she tries again.
"Also, I'm not exactly leaving New York, but I sort of am. I go to Japan tomorrow to do 2 concerts there, and then 1 in Korea. And after that, I come back to New York for a week, and then I really start touring. I'll be on the road for maybe 40 weeks a year, so..."
Not much time for egg hunting?
Something like that.
So this would be like your farewell tour? Of New York? Of me? A little late for me.
That's one way of looking at it, I suppose, Mia replies.
I pause, as though I'm actually considering this, as though I'm weighing my options, as though the RSVP to her invitation is in question. Then I shrug, put on a good show.
Sure, why not?
But I'm still a little iffy about the bus station, so I put on my shades and cap before we go inside. Mia leads me through an orange-tiled hall, the aroma of pine disinfectant not quite masking the smell of piss, and up a series of escalators, past shuttered newsstands and fast food restaurants, up more escalators to a neon sign blaring Leisure Time Bowl.
Here we are,
she says, shyly, proudly.
After I found it by accident, I made a habit of peeking in any time I was in the station. And then I started coming here just to hang out. Sometimes I sit at the bar and order nachos and watch people bowl.
Why not bowl yourself? Mia tilts her head to the side, then taps her elbow. Ah, her elbow. Her Achilles heel. One of the few parts of her body that, it seemed, hadn't been hurt in the accident. Hadn't been encased in plaster, or put together with pins, or stitches, or touched by skin grafts. But when she started playing cello again, in that mad attempt to catch up with herself, her elbow had started to hurt. X-rays were taken, MRIs done. The doctors couldn't find anything wrong, told her it might be a bad bruise or a contused nerve, and suggested she ease off the practicing, which had set Mia off. She said if she couldn't play, she had nothing left. What about me? I remember thinking, but never saying. Anyhow, she'd ignored the doctors and played through the pain, and either it had gotten better or she'd gotten used to it.
I tried to get some people from Juilliard to come down a few times, but they weren't into it. But it doesn't matter, she tells me. It's the place I love. How it's totally secreted away up here. I don't need to bowl to appreciate it.
So your Garden of Eden boyfriend is too highbrow for greasy diners and bowling alleys, huh? Mia and I used to go bowling, sometimes the two of us, other times with her whole family. Kat and Denny had been big bowlers, part of Denny's whole retro thing. Even Teddy could hit an 80. Like it or not, Mia Hall, you have a bit of grunge twined into your DNA thanks to your family. And maybe thanks to me. We could go bowling now, I suggest. Mia smiles at the offer, then taps her elbow again. She shakes her head. You don't have to bowl, I explain. I'll bowl. You can watch. Just for you to get the whole effect. Or I can even bowl for both of us. It seems like you should have one game here, this being your farewell tour.
You'd do that for me?
And it's the surprise in her voice that gets to me.
Yeah, why not?
I haven't been bowling in ages. This isn't entirely true. Bryn and I went bowling a few months ago for some charity thing. We paid $20,000 to rent a lane for an hour for some worthy cause, and then we didn't even bowl. Just drank champagne while Bryn schmoozed. I mean, who drinks champagne at a bowling alley? Inside Leisure Time, it smells like beer, and wax, and hot dogs, and shoe disinfectant. It's what a bowling alley should smell like. The lanes are full of an unusually unattractive grouping of New Yorkers, who actually seem to be bowling for the sake of bowling. They don't look twice at us. They don't even look once at us. I book us a lane and rent us each a pair of shoes. Full treatment here. Mia's practically giddy as she tries hers on, doing a little soft shoe as she selects a lady's pink 8-pounder for me to bowl with on her behalf.
What about names? Mia asks.
Back in the day, we always went for musicians. She'd choose an old-school punk female singer, and I'd pick a male classical musician. Joan and Frederick, or Debbie and Ludwig.
You pick,
I say, because I'm not exactly sure how much of the past we're supposed to be reliving, until I see the names she inputs. And then, I almost fall over. Kat and Denny. When she sees my expression, she looks embarrassed.
They like to bowl too,
she hastily explains, quickly changing the names to Pat and Lenny.
How's that?
She asks, a little too cheerfully. Two letters away from morbid, I think. My hand is shaking again as I step up to the lane with Pat's pink ball, which might explain why I only knocked down 8 pins. Mia doesn't care. She squeals with delight.
A spare will be mine, she yells,
then catches her outburst and looks down at her feet.
Thanks for renting me the shoes. Nice touch.
No problem.
How come nobody recognizes you here? She asks.
It's a context thing.
Maybe you can take off your sunglasses? It's kind of hard talking to you in them.
I forgot that I still had them on and feel stupid for it, and stupid for having to wear them in the first place. I take them off.
Better, Mia says. I don't get why classical musicians think bowling is white trash. It's so fun.
I don't know why this little Juilliard snobs versus the rest of us should make me feel a little digging thrill, but it does. I knock down the remaining two of Mia's pins. She cheers loudly.
Did you like it, Juilliard? I ask. Was it everything you thought it'd be?
No, she says, and again I feel this strange sense of victory, until she elaborates. It was more.
Oh.
Didn't start out that way, though. It was pretty rocky at first.
That's not surprising, you know, all things considered.
That was the problem. All things considered. Too many things considered. When I first got there, it was like everywhere else. People were very considerate. My roommate was so considerate that she couldn't look at me without crying.
The over-empathizer. Her, I remember. I got cut off a few weeks into her.
All my roommates were drama queens. I changed so many times the first year before I finally moved out of the dorms. Do you know I've lived in 11 different places here? I think that must be some kind of record.
Consider it practice for being on the road.
Do you like being on the road?
No.
Really? Getting to see all those different countries? I would have thought you'd love that.
All I get to see is the hotel and the venue and the blur of the countryside from the window of a tour bus.
Don't you ever sightsee?
The band does. They go out on these private VIP tours, hit the Rome Coliseum before it's open to the public and things like that. I could tag along, but it would mean going with a band, so I just wind up holed up in my hotel. There's not usually time, I lie. So you were saying you had roommate issues?
Yeah, Mia continues. Sympathy overload. It was like that with everyone, including the faculty, who were all kinds of nervous around me, when it should have been the opposite. It's kind of a rite of passage when you first take orchestra to have your playing deconstructed, basically picked apart in front of everyone. And it happened to everybody, except me. It was like I was invisible. Nobody dared critique me. And trust me, it wasn't because my playing was so great.
Maybe it was, I say. I edge closer, drying my hands over the blower.
No, it wasn't. One of the courses you have to take when you first start is string quartet survey. And one of the profs is this guy, Lemsky. He's a bigwig in the department. Russian. Imagine every cruel stereotype you can think of. That's him. Mean, shriveled up little man. Straight out of Dostoevsky. My dad would have loved him. After a few weeks, I get called into his office. This is not usually a happy sign. He's sitting behind this messy wooden desk with papers and sheet music piled high. And he starts telling me about his family. Jews in the Ukraine. Lived through pogroms. Then through World War II. Then he says, everyone has hardship in their life. Everyone has pain. The faculty here will coddle you because of what you went through. I, however, am of the opinion if we do that, that car crash might as well have killed you too, because we will smother your talent. Do you want us to do that? And I didn't know how to respond, so I just stood there. And then he yelled at me, do you? Do you want us to smother you? And I managed to eke out a no. And he says, good. Then he picks up his baton and sort of flicks me out with it.
I can think of places I'd like to stick that guy's baton. I grab my ball and hurl it down the lane. It hits the pin formation with a satisfying thwack. The pins go flying in every direction like little humans fleeing Godzilla. When I get back to Mia, I'm calmer.
Nice one, she says at the same time I say, your professor sounds like a dick.
True, he's not the most socially graced.
And I was freaked out at the time, but looking back, I think that was one of the most important days of my life, because he was the first person who didn't just give me a pass.
I turn, glad to have a reason to walk away from her so she can't see the look on my face. I throw her pink ball down the lane, but the torque is off and it veers to the right. I get 7 down and the remaining 3 are split. I only pick off one more on my next go. To even things up, I purposely blow my next frame, knocking down 6 pins.
So, a few days later in orchestra, Mia continues, my glissando gets taken apart, and not very kindly.
She grins, awash in happy memories of her humiliation. Nothing like a public flogging.
Right? It was great. It was like the best therapy in the world.
I look at her. Therapy was once a forbidden word. Mia had been assigned a grief counselor in the hospital and rehab, but had refused to continue seeing anyone once she'd come home, something Kim and I had argued against. But Mia had claimed that talking about her dead family an hour a week wasn't therapeutic.
Once that happened, it was like everyone else on the faculty relaxed around me, she tells me. Lemsky rode me extra hard. No time off. No life that wasn't cello. Summers, I played festivals. Aspen, then Marlboro. Then Lemsky and Ernesto both pushed me to audition for the Young Concert Artists program, which was insane. It makes getting into Juilliard look like a cakewalk. But I did it, and I got in. That's why I was at Carnegie tonight. 20-year-olds don't normally play recitals at Sankel Hall. And that's just thrown all these doors wide open. I have management now. I have agents interested in me. And that's why Lemsky pushed for early graduation. He said I was ready to start touring, though I don't know if he's right.
From what I heard tonight, he's right. Her face is suddenly so eager, so young, it almost hurts.
Do you really think so? I've been playing recitals and festivals, but this will be different. This will be me on my own. Or soloing for a few nights with an orchestra or a quartet or a chamber music ensemble.
She shakes her head.
Some days, I think I should just find a permanent position in an orchestra, have some continuity, like you have with the band. It has to be such a comfort to always be with Liz, Mike, and Fitzy.
The stage changes, but the players stay the same. I think of the band, on an airplane as we speak, speeding across the Atlantic. A notion, the least of the things dividing us now. And then I think of Mia, of the way she played the Dvorak, of what all the people in the theater were saying after she left the stage. No, you shouldn't do that. That would be a waste of your talent.
Now you sound like Lemsky.
Great. Mia laughs.
Oh, I know he comes across as such a hard ass, but I suspect deep down he's doing this because he thinks by giving me a shot at a career, he'll help fill some void.
Mia stops and turns to me, her eyes dead on mine, searching, reaching.
But he doesn't have to give me the career. That's not what fills the void. You understand that, right? You always understood that.
Suddenly all the shit from the day comes ricocheting back. Vanessa and Bryn and the bump watches and shuffle and the looming 67 days of separate hotels and awkward silences and playing shows with a band behind me that no longer has my back. And it's like, Mia, don't you get it? The music is the void, and you're the reason why. Chapter 11. Shooting Star had always been a band with a code. Feelings first, business second. So I hadn't given the band much thought, hadn't considered their feelings or the resentments about my extended leave. I figured they'd get my absence without my having to explain. After I came out of my haze and wrote those first 10 songs, I called Liz, who organized a band dinner meeting. During dinner, we sat around the club table, so named because Liz had taken this fugly 1970s wooden dining table we'd found on the curb and covered it with band flyers and about 1,000 layers of lacquer to resemble the inside of a club. First, I apologized for going MIA. Then I pulled out my laptop and played them recordings of the new stuff I'd been writing. Liz's and Fitzy's eyes went wide. They dangled vegetable lasagna in front of their mouths as they listened to track after track. Bridge. Dust. Stitch. Roulette. Animate.
Dude, we thought you were just packing it in, working some crap-ass job and pining, but you've been productive, Fitzy exclaimed. This shit rocks!
Liz nodded.
It does, and it's beautiful too. It must have been cathartic, she said, reaching over to squeeze my hand. I'd love to read the lyrics. Do you have them on your computer?
Scrawled on paper at home. I'll transcribe them and email them to you.
Home? Isn't this home?
Liz asked. Your room is an untouched museum. Why don't you move back? Not much to move, unless you sold my stuff.
We tried. Too dusty, no takers, Fitzy said.
We've been using your bed as a hat rack, though. Fitzy shot me a wise-ass grin. I'd made the mistake of telling him how I'd thought I was turning into my dead grandfather, with all his weird superstitions, like his vehement belief that hats on beds bring bad luck.
"Don't worry, we'll burn sage," Liz said. Clearly Fitzy had alerted the media.
"So what? That's it?" Mike said, tapping his nails against my laptop.
"Dude, that's 10 songs, Fitzy said, a piece of spinach in his giant grin. 10 insanely good songs. That's practically an album. We already have enough to go into the studio.
"Those are just the ones that are done," I interrupted. "I've got at least 10 more coming. I don't know what's going on, but they're just kind of flowing out of me right now. Like they're already written and recorded and someone just pressed play. I'm getting it all out as fast as I can."
"Obey the muse," Liz said. "She's a fickle mistress."
"I'm not talking about the songs," Mike said. "We don't even know if there will be any album, if any of the labels will still want us. We had all this forward momentum and he basically killed it."
"He didn't kill anything," Liz said. "For one, it's only been a few months. And second of all, our Smiling Simon album has been ripping up the indie charts, getting tons of play on the college stations. And I've been working the college angle pretty well," Liz continued, "with interviews and all, to keep the embers burning. And dude, Perfect World has even crossed over. It's getting play on satellite radio stations," Fitzy said. "I'm sure all those A&R guys will be happy to see us, shitting bricks to hear this."
"You don't know," Mike said. "They have their trends, quotas, the outfits they want. And my point is, he jabbed a finger at me, ditches the band without a word and just waltzes back like it's no big deal."
Mike had a point, but it wasn't like I held anyone back.
"Look, I'm sorry. We all go off the cliff sometimes, but you could have replaced me if you'd wanted to, gotten a new guitar player in your major label deal."
By the quick look that passed among the three of them, I could see that this option had been discussed and likely vetoed by Liz. Shooting Star was a democratic outfit. We'd always made decisions together, but when it came down to it, the band was Liz's. She started it and recruited me to play guitar after seeing me play around town. Then she'd lassoed Fitzy and Mike, so ultimately a personnel change would have been her call. Maybe this was why Mike had started playing gigs with another drummer under the name of Ranch Hand.
"Mike, I don't get what you want out of this," Fitzy said. "Do you want a box of chocolates? Do you want Adam to get you a nice bouquet to say sorry?"
"Piss off, Fitz," Mike said.
"I'll buy you flowers," I offered. "Yellow roses. I believe those symbolize friendship. Whatever it takes, I'll do what I'm told."
"Will that make it good?" Fitzy continued. "Because what the fuck, man? We have these amazing songs. I wish I'd written those songs, but Adam did. He came through and we have him back. So maybe now we can get back to making kick-ass music and see where it takes us. And maybe, you know, let our kid get a little joy back in his life. So dude, bygones."
Mike's worries turned out to be unfounded. Some of the major labels that had been courting us in the fall had cooled on us, but a handful were still interested. And when we sent them the demos of the songs that would become Collateral Damage, they went ballistic, and we were signed and in the studio with Gus before we knew it. And for a while, things were good. Fitzy and Liz were both right. Recording Collateral Damage was cathartic. And there was joy. Working with Gus was intense. He brought out the noise in us, told us not to be scared of our raw power, and we all ran with it. And it was cool being up in Seattle recording and staying in a corporate apartment and feeling like the shit. Everything seemed good. Not long after the record came out, the tour started. A 5-month slog through North America, Europe, and Asia that, at the outset, seemed like the most exciting thing in the world. And in the beginning, it was. But it was also grueling. And soon I was tired all the time. And lonely. There was a lot of empty time in which to miss her. I kind of holed away in my hotel rooms, the backs of tour buses. I pushed everyone away, even Liz. Especially Liz. She wasn't stupid. She knew what was going on and why. And she wasn't some fragile flower either. She kept after me. So I burrowed until I guess she got tired of trying to dig me out. As the tour went on, the album just started going haywire. Platinum, then double platinum. The tour dates sold out, so our promoters added additional ones to meet demand. The merchandising deals were everywhere. Shooting Star t-shirts, caps, posters, stickers, even a special edition Shooting Star telescope. Suddenly, the press was all over us. interviews all the time, which was flattering at first. People cared enough about us to read what we had to say. But a weird thing started to happen in interviews. The reporter would sit the band down together, ask some perfunctory questions to us all, and then turn the microphone or camera on me. And I tried to open it up to the rest of the band.
That's when reporters started requesting interviews with just me, a request I uniformly turned down until it suddenly became impossible for us to do interviews any other way.
About 4 months into the tour, we were in Rome. Rolling Stone had sent a reporter to spend a few days with us. One night after a show, we were closing the hotel bar. It was a pretty mellow scene, and we were sitting around, decompressing, pounding grappa. But then the reporter starts firing away with all these heavy-duty questions, all to me. I mean, there were about a dozen of us in there. Me, Liz, Fitzy, Mike, Aldous, some roadies, some groupies. But this guy was acting like I was the only person in the room.
Adam, do you see collateral damage as having a single narrative? If so, can you elaborate on it? Adam, do you think this record represents your growth as a songwriter? Adam, you've mentioned in other interviews you don't want to go down that dark rock star path, but how do you keep from suffocating on your own fumes?
Mike just lost it.
You hijacked the band,
he screamed at me, like it was just the two of us in a room, like there wasn't a reporter right there.
This isn't just the Adam Wilde show, you know. We're a band, a unit. There are four of us. Or did you forget that on your way down the dark rock star path?
Mike turned to the reporter.
You want to know about the illustrious Adam Wilde? I've got some choice details. Like, our rock star over here has to do this crazy voodoo shit before each show and is such a prima donna that if you whistle backstage before a show, he has a tantrum because of the bad luck.
Mike, come on, Liz interrupted sharply. All artists have their rituals. The reporter, meanwhile, was scribbling away, eating all this up, until Aldous diplomatically said that everyone was tired and shooed everyone but the band out of the bar and tried to get me and Mike to make nice. But then Mike just let loose for round two of insults, telling me what a spotlight-hogging asshole I'd become. I looked over at Liz to come to my defense again, but she was staring intently at her drink, so I turned to Fitzy, but he just shook his head.
I never thought I'd be the one to say this, but... Grow up, you two.
Then he left. I looked pleadingly at Liz. She looked sympathetic, but tired.
Mike, you were out of line in there, she said flatly. But then she turned to me and shook her head. But Adam, come on. You've got to try to see it from his perspective, from all of ours. It's tough to be big about this, especially when you've retreated from us. I get why you have, but that doesn't make it any easier.
All of them. They were all against me. I waved my hands in surrender. I ran out of the bar, strangely close to tears. In the lobby, this Italian model named Raffaella, who'd been hanging with us, was waiting for a taxi. She smiled when she saw me. When her taxi came, she gestured with her head, inviting me inside, and I went. The next day, I checked into a different hotel from the band. The story hit RollingStone.com almost immediately, and the tabloids a few days later. Our label freaked, as did our tour promoters, all of whom warned of the various forms of hell there would be to pay if we didn't honor our concert commitments. Aldous flew in a professional mediator to talk to me and Mike. She was useless. Her genius idea, a legacy that continues to this day, is what Fitzy refers to as the divorce. I would continue to stay at one hotel for the remainder of the tour, the rest of the band at another. And her publicist decided it was safer to keep me and Mike separate in interviews, so now reporters often talk to me solo. Yeah, those changes have helped a lot. When I got back from the collateral damage tour, I almost quit the band. I moved out of the house I'd been sharing with Fitzy in Portland and into my own place. I avoided those guys. I was angry, but also ashamed. I wasn't sure how, but I clearly ruined everything. I might have just let the run end there. But Liz stopped by my new place one afternoon and asked me to just give it a few months' breathing space and see how I felt.
Anyone would be going a little nuts after the couple years we've had, especially the couple of years you've had, she'd said,
which was about as much as we acknowledged Mia.
I'm not asking you to do anything. I'm just asking you to not do anything and see how you feel in a few months.
Then the album started winning all these awards, and then I met Bryn and moved to L.A. and didn't have to deal with them much, so I just wound up getting sucked in for another round. Bryn's the only person who knows how close to the edge that tour pushed me, and how badly I've been dreading this upcoming one.
Cut them loose, is her solution. She thinks I have some sort of guilt complex, coming from humble origins and all, and that's why I won't go solo.
Look, I get it. It's hard to accept that you deserve the acclaim, but you do. You write all the songs and most of the music, and that's why you get all the attention, she tells me. You're the talent, not just some pretty face. If this were a movie, you'd be the $20 million star, and they'd be the supporting players. But instead, you all get an equal split, she says. You don't need them, especially with all the grief they give you.
But it's not about the money. It never has been. And going solo doesn't seem like much of a solution. It would just be out of the frying pan and into the fire, and there'd still be touring to contend with, the thought of which has been making me physically sick.
Why don't you call Dr. Weisbluth?
Bryn suggested on the phone from Toronto, where she was wrapping her latest film. Weisbluth's the psychopharmacologist the label had hooked me up with a few months earlier.
See if he can give you something a little stronger. And when you get back, we need to have a sit-down with Brooke and seriously talk about you going solo. But you have to get through this tour. You'll blow your reputation otherwise.
There are worse things to blow than your reputation, aren't there? That's what I thought, but I didn't say it. I just called Weisbluth, got some more scripts, and steeled myself for the tour. I guess Bryn understood, like I understood, like everyone who knew me understood, that in spite of his bad boy rep, Adam Wilde does as he's told. Chapter 12. There's a piece of lead where my heart should beat. Doctor said too dangerous to take out. You better just leave it be. Body grew back around it, a miracle, praise be. Now, if only I could get through airport security. Bullet. Collateral damage, track 12. Mia doesn't tell me what the next destination is. Says because it's her secret New York tour, it should be a secret. And then proceeds to lead me out of Port Authority, down, 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 into a warren of subway tunnels. And I follow her. Even though I don't like secrets. Even though I think that Mia and I have enough secrets between the two of us at this point. And even though the subway is like the culmination of all my fears, enclosed spaces, lots of people, no escape. I sort of mention this to her, but she throws back what I said earlier in the bowling alley about context.
Who's going to be expecting Adam Wilde on the subway at 3 in the morning, without an entourage?
She gives me a joking smile.
Besides, it should be dead at this hour, and in my New York, I always take the train.
When we reach the Times Square subway station, the place is so crowded that it might as well be 5 p.m. on a Thursday.
My warning bell starts to ping. Even more so once we get to the thronged platform. I stiffen and back toward one of the pillars. Mia gives me a look. This is a bad idea, I mumble, but my worries are drowned out by the oncoming train.
The trains don't run often at night, so it must be that everyone's been waiting for a while, Mia shouts over the clatter. But here comes one now, so look, everything's fine.
When we get on the N, we both see that Mia's wrong. The car is packed with people. Drunk people. I feel the itchiness of eyes on me. I know I'm out of pills, but I need a cigarette. Now. I reach for my pack.
You can't smoke on the train, Mia whispers.
I need to.
It's illegal.
I don't care. If I get arrested, at least I'd be in the safety of police custody. Suddenly, she goes all Vulcan.
If the purpose is to not call attention to yourself, don't you think that perhaps lighting up is counterproductive?
She pulls me into a corner.
It's fine, she croons, and I half expect her to caress my neck like she used to do when I'd get tense. We'll just hang out here. If it doesn't empty out at 34th Street, we'll get off.
At 34th, a bunch of people do get off, and I feel a little better. At 14th, more people get off. But then suddenly at Canal, our car fills up with a group of hipsters. I angle myself into the far end of the train, near the conductor's booth, so my back is to the riders. It's hard for most people to understand how freaked out I get by large crowds in small contained spaces now. I think it would be hard for the me of 3 years ago to understand. But that me never had the experience of minding his own business at a small record shop in Minneapolis when one guy recognized me and shouted out my name, and it was like watching popcorn kernels in hot oil. First one wind, then another, then an explosion of them, until all these sedate record store slackers suddenly became a mob, surrounding me, then tackling me. I couldn't breathe. I couldn't move.
It sucks because I like the fans when I meet them individually. I do. But get a group of them together and this swarm instinct takes over, and they seem to forget that you're a mere mortal, flesh and bone, bruisable, and scarable. But we seem okay in the corner, until I make the fatal mistake of doing just one final check over my shoulder to make sure no one's looking at me. And in that little quarter second, it happens. I catch someone's eye. I feel the recognition ignite like a match. I can almost smell the phosphorus in the air. Then everything seems to happen in slow motion. First I hear it. It goes unnaturally quiet. And then there's a low buzz as the news travels. I hear my name and stage whispers move across the noisy train. I see elbows nudged, cell phones reached for, bags grabbed, forces rallied, legs shuffling. None of this takes longer than a few seconds, but it's always agonizing, like the moments when a first punch is thrown but hasn't yet connected. One guy with a beard is preparing to step out of his seat, opening his mouth to call my name. I know he means me no harm, but once he outs me, the whole train will be on me. 30 seconds to all hell breaks loose. I grab Mia's arm and yank.
Ow!
I have the door between subway cars open, and we're pushing into the next car.
What are you doing?
She says, flailing behind me. I'm not listening. I'm pulling her into another car, then another, until the train slows into a station, and then I'm tugging her out of the train, onto the platform, up the stairs, taking them two at a time. Some part of my brain vaguely warning me that I'm being too rough, but the other part not giving a shit. Once up on the street, I pull her along for a few blocks until I'm sure no one is following us. Then I stop.
Are you trying to get us killed?
She yells. I feel a bolt of guilt shoot through me, but I throw the bolt right back at her.
Well, what about you? Are you trying to get me attacked by a mob?
I look down and realize that I'm still holding her hand. Mia looks too. I let go.
What mob, Adam?
She asks softly. She's talking to me like I'm a crazy person now, just like Aldous talks to me when I have one of my panic attacks. But at least Aldous would never accuse me of fantasizing a fan attack. He's seen it happen too many times.
I got recognized down there, I mutter, walking away from her.
Mia hesitates for a second, then skitters to catch up.
Nobody knew it was you.
Her ignorance, the luxury of that ignorance.
The whole car knew it was me. What are you talking about, Adam?
What am I talking about? I'm talking about having photographers camped out in front of my house. I'm talking about not having gone record shopping in almost 2 years. I'm talking about not being able to take a walk without feeling like a deer on the opening day of hunting season. I'm talking about every time I have a cold, it showing up in a tabloid as a coke habit.
I look at her there in the shadows of the shutdown city, her hair falling onto her face, and I can see her trying to figure out if I've lost it. And I have to fight the urge to take her by the shoulders and slam her against a shuttered building until we feel the vibrations ringing through both of us. Because I suddenly want to hear her bones rattle. I want to feel the softness of her flesh give, to hear her gasp as my hip bone jams into her. I want to yank her head back until her neck is exposed. I want to rip my hands through her hair until her breath is labored. I want to make her cry and then lick up the tears. And then I want to take my mouth to hers. To devour her alive, to transmit all the things she can't understand.
This is bullshit. Where the hell are you taking me anyway? The adrenaline thrumming through me turns my voice into a growl. Mia looks taken aback.
I told you, I'm taking you to my secret New York haunts.
Yeah, well, I'm a little over secrets. Do you mind telling me where we're going? Is that too much to fucking ask?
Christ, Adam, when did you become such a...
egomaniac? Asshole? Narcissist? I could fill in the blank with a million words. They've all been said before.
Guy!
Mia finishes. For a second, I almost laugh. Guy? That's the best she's got? It reminds me of the story my parents tell about me. How when I was a little kid and would get angry, I'd get so worked up and then curse them out by going, you, piston... like it was the worst thing ever. But then I remember something else. An old conversation Mia and I had late one night. She and Kim had this habit of categorizing everything into diametric categories, and Mia was always announcing a new one. One day she told me that they decided that my gender was divvied into two neat piles. Men and guys. Basically, all the saints of the world. Men.
The jerks, the players, the wet t-shirt contest aficionados, they were guys. Back then, I was a man. So I'm a guy now? A guy? I allow my hurt to show for half a second. Mia's looking at me with confusion, but not remembering a thing. Whoever said that the past isn't dead had it backward. It's the future that's already dead, already played out. This whole night has been a mistake. It's not going to let me rewind, or unmake the mistakes I've made, or the promises I've made, or have her back, or have me back. Something's changed in Mia's face. Some type of recognition has clicked on. Because she's explaining herself, how she called me a guy, because guys always need to know the plan, the directions, and how she's taking me on the Staten Island ferry, which isn't really a secret, but it's something few Manhattanites ever do. Which is a shame, because there's this amazing view of the Statue of Liberty, and on top of that, the ferry is free, and nothing in New York is free. But if I'm worried about crowds, we can forget it. But we can also just check it out, and if it's not empty, and she's pretty sure it will be this time of night, we can get right back off before it leaves.
And I have no idea if she remembered that conversation about the man-guy distinction or not, but it doesn't really matter anymore.
Because she's right. I am a guy now. And I can peg the precise night I turned into one. Chapter 13. The groupies started showing up right away. Or maybe they'd always been there and I just hadn't noticed. But as soon as we started touring, they were buzzing about like hummingbirds dipping their beaks into spring flowers. One of the first things we did after we signed with the label was hire Aldous to manage us. Collateral Damage was due to come out in September, and the label planned a modest tour in the late fall, but Aldous had different ideas.
"You guys need to get your sea legs back," Aldous said when we finished mixing the album. "You need to get back on the road."
So right as the album came out, Aldous booked us a series of 10 tour dates up and down the West Coast in clubs we'd played in before to reconnect with our fan base, or to remind them that we still existed, and to get comfortable playing in front of an audience again. The label rented us a nice Econoline van, tricked out with a bed in the back and a trailer to haul our gear. But other than that, when we set out, it didn't feel that different from the shows we'd always played. It was completely different. For one, right away, and for whatever reason, Animate was breaking out as a hit single. Even over the course of the two-week tour, its momentum was building, and as that happened, you could feel it in every consecutive show we played. They went from well-attended to packed to sold out to lines around the corner to fire marshals showing up. All in the matter of 2 weeks. And the energy. It was like a live wire. Like everyone at the shows knew we were right there on the verge and they wanted to be a part of it. A part of our history. It was like we were all in on this secret together. Maybe that's why these were the best, most frenetic, rocking shows we'd ever played. Tons of stage diving and people shouting along to the songs, even though nobody had heard any of our new stuff before. And I felt pretty good, pretty vindicated, because even though it was just a matter of pure luck that things had gone this way, I hadn't blown it for the band after all. The groupies just seemed part of this wave of energy, this growing swell of fandom. At first, I didn't even think of them as groupies, because a lot of the girls I'd known vaguely from the scene. Except whereas before, they'd been friendly. Now they were brazen in their flirting. After one of our first shows in San Francisco, this hipster chick named Viv, who I'd known for a few years, came backstage. She had glossy black hair and wiry arms covered in a daisy chain of tattoos. She gave me a huge hug and then a kiss on the mouth. She hung by my side all night long, her hand resting on the small of my back. At that point, I'd been out of commission for well over a year. Mia and I, well, she'd been in the hospital, then in rehab, and even if she hadn't been covered in stitches, plaster, and pressure bandages, there was no way. All those fantasies about sexy hospital sponge baths are a joke. There is no place less of a turn-on than a hospital. The smell alone is one of putrefaction, the opposite of desire. When she'd come home, it had been to a downstairs room that had been her grand sewing room, which we'd turn into Mia's bedroom. I'd slept on a nearby couch in the living room. There were spare rooms on the second floor, but Mia, who was still walking with a cane, couldn't handle the stairs at first, and I hadn't wanted to be even that far away. Even though I was spending every night at Mia's, I'd never officially moved out of the House of Rock,
And one night, a few months after Mia had come back to her grandparents, she'd suggested we go there. After dinner with Liz and Sarah, Mia had tugged me up to my room. The minute the door clicked shut behind us, she'd pounced on me, kissing me with her mouth wide open, like she was trying to swallow me whole. I'd been taken aback at first, freaked out by the sudden ardor, worried that it was going to hurt her, and also not really wanting to look at the stubbly red scar.